This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of the Amusement Warehouse Podcast. We have a special edition this week. Since it's our first year doing it, we're kind of making it up as we go along, but we thought maybe doing a year-end wrap-up type issue would be a great thing for Christmas and the new year. So I brought on my partner, Matt Cook, the founder of Amusement Warehouse, with his little message board that he started a billion years ago. Talk to us, Matt.
That's right.
Thanks for coming on under duress. He fought the whole way, but he's here.
I did fight the whole way. He had to bring me in kicking and screaming, but I'm here. Am I a guest? I don't know. What am I on this? Am I a guest on the show? I was trying to debate that in my head.
You're never a guest, Matt. You're always welcome. You can co-host whatever you want to do.
Okay. Well, yeah. So Carnival Warehouse has been around for a long time now. Like Ron said, the message board started in 1997 and it grew in popularity throughout the industry. You know, it was kind of the first of its kind. You know, back then everything else was print at the time, you know, between amusement business and, you know, Carnival Magazine, I guess, was around at that point. But that's kind of how it all started. And Ron kind of came on board, I would say, what year? I don't know, 2024, somewhere around then, or 2004. 2024 is now.
2004. Yeah. I mean, I just saw the opportunity to be like a news thing with amusement business, going from a weekly to a monthly, and just the internet in general. I said to Matt, we could write stories and put them like right up on the internet and they'd be there. You know, we don't have to wait a week or a month to get the information out. So we started doing that. And Matt and I basically did everything. I wrote all the stories and Matt posted them and managed the message board. And we had a little help from the late Chris helped us we had a lot of refereeing to do on the message board sometimes. And the rest, is history. We've grown. It's 20 years, huh? Wow.
20 years. Yeah. I didn't think of it that way, but yeah, about 20 years. You know, I remember one of our first articles, back then it was right around the time when the name acquisition happened, when, Fred Rosen from Ticketmaster was involved. And, we did an article. And I remember, I think I was in Gibbtown at the time, and I got a phone call and I answered. I didn't know what number it was. I answered it. And it was someone that said, Matt Cook. I said, yes. He said, please hold for Fred Rosen. And I just, my jaw dropped like, oh my God, what do I do?
Ron did it. It. Exactly. I didn't even know he published it.
So that was one of our first major articles and stories, and it was kind of, you know, eye-opening. You know, we knew a lot of people in the industry read the website at the time, but you know,
we used to joke like it was like at first, you know, back then 2004, it was like porn. Like nobody admitted they looked at it or something like that, and then you'd start hearing people and they'd be like, oh yeah, blah blah blah. I was in West Palm with Wade shows with Frank Zychek, and he was telling us that nobody reads it that much, you know, all that stuff. He's the only one. But a reporter came from the whatever their newspaper is down there, and he was talking to Frank, and then he goes, you know, I was reading in Carnival Warehouse that I see. Frank looks at me like I prompted him to say it or something like that. And then he brought it up again. He's like, did you tell him to say that? I said, no, and I just met this guy. I have no idea who he was, but it really took on its own thing. I think the message board to a certain extent was a drag with some of the more prominent carnival owners, because there was some, you know, sort of nonsense on there sometimes or a lot of, it's fun and all that stuff. And people said crazy things, but you know, I think people took a little offense at it to a certain extent. So as that waned and the news part went up, I think we became a lot more credible or something, whatever we are.
Credible, yeah. No, I think you're right. I mean, I remember, you know, in the early days, you know, with some of the carnival fans, or maybe even, you know, joinies or, you know, concessionaires who would be booked in on a show, you know, they would go on the message board under like a fake alias, and they would be in there, you know, criticizing
another show or something.
Another show. Yeah, it was kind of funny, you know, because then the show owner would be on there reading it and
yell at us, call or something, call me or call you. And
yeah, take that off there. Or I know one.
I don't read it, but somebody told me.
Someone said it was on there.
And they can quote it word for word. I was like, okay.
For one story where one of the you know, fans or whatever, you know, whoever it was on there, you know, criticizing the lights on the giant wheel, and you know, the show owner was on there reading it and, you know, called his maintenance guy and said, hey, go fix the lights on the giant wheel, you know. He read it on our message board first, I guess, but
no, but it's been a fun ride. I mean, we took over the top 50 list and started, you know, covering amusement parks and fairs and you know, we're now, it was funny because I was curious about amusement business and like circulation and stuff like that. And I think the number was, you know, like 4,000 or 5,000 subscribers at the end there or something along those lines. And, you know, online we have 50,000 unique readers, or probably more now a month, you know, plus the podcast, plus the printed edition, which we send to all the fairs and all the carnivals and all the different places. And it's, you know, we're by far the largest industry publication, you know, the kind of that ever existed. I don't know, Billboard, you know, Billboard, obviously, because you had multiple industries. I'm sure a lot of people subscribe, but it's pretty neat. It's pretty neat to accomplish. And now with this podcast has been, you know, I really had no idea. And I don't think you did either until, because we've been talking about it. I've been talking about it the last couple of years. I want to start it and do it. And, you know, the guests came on pretty easily and it's been good conversations. And I think it's great to get to know some of these, you know, show owners or park owners or fair managers, and we've had great guests. And, you know, I don't think it was till IAPA, which I really realized, because we talked to so many people there and everybody listens to it. It was almost crazy. And then Pete Downs made t-shirts too. So that was really crazy.
That was pretty good. Yeah. No, I was really surprised too. You know, we went around IAPA and, you know, people would walk up and say, oh yeah, I listened to every episode, or yeah, I listened to that one, but I haven't listened to this week's yet, or, you know, something like that. And, you know, I knew
what
people
you'd expect
were
from
listening.
A podcast, because people listen to what they're most interested in first, and then they.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I think it's so versatile, because, you know, people in this industry can, you know, they can listen when they're driving, or, you know, maybe they're pulling a load or something like that on a Sunday night and they put it on or listen to it. You know, it's kind of
cool.
I'm
curious to see if listenership goes up in the winter when people aren't doing as much, if they're listening, or if they're more inclined to do it when they're driving. But we'll see. We'll see how things go. We got some great guests coming up before too long, but I thought what we'd do with this episode is just kind of go over the year and talk about some trends or things that interested us during the course of the year. And for that reason, Matt, we have a special guest.
Oh, I can't wait.
The first ever seen by any human, Tim Herrick. Tim.
Hey.
Matt, I don't think you've ever seen him before, too.
We have not seen each other, and I'm surprised how bald we all are. Although the crazy thing is, just let me get this out of the way, Matt, is that Matt and I grew up in the same town. We're both from Paramus, New Jersey, which.
Okay, that's Ron. Everybody wants to call me Matt. I don't understand it. Like, even the podcast.
Oh, I see. No, I had the.
Somebody
the
wrote Matt and they're like, you did a good job with the podcast.
Right. Okay. Well, nonetheless, we're still all bald. But hey, Matt, Ron, I've talked to you guys on the phone, and I've talked to a lot of the industry on the phone, but I don't really Zoom or anything. So, but anyway, Matt and I are from the same hometown of Paramus.
Ron and I are from the same town. My
Ron,
gosh.
Ron, I'm sorry. Ron and I, Matt is right in my visual here on the stamp
You're
screen.
Obsessed with him. It's a little scary, I think.
Because you don't have a name tag, Ron. You just say amusement warehouse. You're like
that's right.
You know, the man right in the dark up there.
Yeah, right.
No but one knows who you are.
Anyway,
I never carried cards for years either.
In my long and sordid career of working in trade magazine business publishing, I've never met anybody from Paramus.
Didn't your like late mom also
Oh, she worked
secretary at my church.
Our Lady of Visitation.
Our Lady school, of Visitation.
Which I went to as a kid.
You went to school there?
Oh, yeah. Didn't you?
No.
Oh. You went to
Spring Valley Elementary, which they tore down, Eastbrook Middle and Paramus High.
Oh, they tore down that Spring Valley? That's by a nice little park. You know?
That was a great school.
Oh. Well, but anyway.
Ol' Aviv was my church for my whole life. Yep. Until I got older.
Okay. Well,
Matt, by the way, I was just kidding.
Well, it's been a wild ride, guys. It was interesting to hear the history with the message board and all that.
You could hear that?
Yeah. I heard the intro while I was in the green room.
Did you hear the things we said about your writing? Or no? I thought that was private.
I didn't hear anything about that.
Now, Tim, you've taken to the industry pretty well. I mean, you're definitely curious. You ask questions, and
I'm very curious. And matter of fact, what's surprising is that I'm actually more curious now than I was when I started. Like, because the industry has evolved in very interesting ways, and its tentacles reach out to a lot of areas of the economy and the culture, which is still reaching out and expanding, and it's very interesting to observe and be part of.
So I thought what we'd do today is just kind of review a few of the things we've seen this year. What are you doing, an eye exam?
No, my one eye looks weird. Yeah. I don't know.
It does look a little red. I thought we'd go over kind of some of the things we saw this year. Maybe, I hate to say it because Tim's going to have these ideas, but trends maybe in the industry.
Yes.
Things we're seeing and where we're going. We just put out the top 50 list. So maybe we'll start there. Matt, I don't know if you know Tim, but Matt and I, not a lot, but we've gotten a little bit of some of the fairs are saying, well, attendance is not really the metric we want to use to, show things. And look, whatever metric you use is fine, but attendance is something that is indicative of how well the fair is doing to a certain extent. You want to get people to come and most of them anyway are nonprofits. So nonprofits, and Tim, you have a little bit of background with some nonprofits, but nonprofits should be transparent as far as their data and things that are going on. And because they're owned by the public, they're not owned by specific people. They're owned by the public.
It's an imperfect metric, but it's also inescapable. You know what I mean? Because it's easy and it's something that people can easily identify. It's, specific and it's a gauge of something. Unfortunately, it's not a gauge of the entire fair and all the stuff the fair does. So, it's something you have to mention, but I try not to get, like with the articles, the recap articles on fairs, I always tell the fairs, because I always have to ask them, revenue and all that kind of stuff, is that I don't want the articles to get bogged down with numbers, but you need the numbers to sort of give context and underlying points and all that. So,
and I also find most of the time when they don't want to give numbers, they have a reason. Was that a bad year? Something didn't work out well or something else, and then when they had a good year and a record attendance, they're more than happy to give it in general. I'm not saying, some people are principled and just don't want to.
As one fair manager told me after a very rainy, rain out year, said that if it didn't rain, I would have been a genius. When I asked them all about, what programs they had and that kind of thing, and they said, well, if it didn't rain, I would have been a genius because we did a lot of great things. But a lot of times, if it rains, or you could do all the great social media and marketing, the rain is still going to keep people away. What's also very the fly in the ointment with that is when the weathermen predict rain and it never comes, and people make the decision that day, oh, it's going to rain. Let's not go to the fair. Let's go to the mall. And that's always sort of that. It turns out to be a nice day. I hear that a lot.
That's the worst. Yeah, I've seen that firsthand. That's always the worst. It turns out to be a nice and sunny afternoon and nobody shows up because the weatherman said it was going to rain. It was 80% chance of rain or something like that. And
yeah.
I think fairs too, they shouldn't be embarrassed. I mean, the weather is one thing that no one could control. I mean, we, They haven't figured out a way to control the weather yet. So, I mean, you can't be embarrassed if your fare is down because, you had a rainy Saturday or a rainy Sunday or, one of your top days was rained out. I mean, it's inevitable at some point, unless you're
Yeah.
in one of those
Yeah, it's not a
climates that gets
shaming to
perfect
be
weather.
down. It's not like like you say, there's so many factors that could, it's not
But
because you're a bad fare manager or something happened. It's just, a lot of times it's weather.
The fact of the matter is the main economic engine of all the fares is the Midway, and the rain is going to impact the Midway the most of all. So
good. The funny thing is, and I don't know if you've noticed this, Tim, but I've always noticed it over the years, and excuse me, running events really got me attuned to it. But it rains, and we think, or if you think as an outsider a little bit, you think, your attendance could go to zero or something like that. It's almost, I mean, I'm going to say never, but as far as most cases, it's never the case that you're down 50%. How many fares have you seen on the list that are down 50%? None. It doesn't
no,
happen. You're down
no,
10%, you're down 20%, you're up 10%, you're up 5%. It's
yeah.
really, the range is only this big. It really is. I mean, and you think it's not, and you're scared of the rain, and you should be. It can hurt because 10% can be a lot of money, depending on what you're doing. But really, it's not that scary where you're going to go to zero. You're going to go, and again, there's a hurricane or something horrible happens. Yeah, it could. But it's very, 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 very rare for something like that to happen when you really think about it.
Yeah, no. It seemed like all the decreases this year on the list, I think the highest was a 15% decrease. And the increases were even were better than the decreases in terms of the top 50 list.
So
In that, okay.
one of the things Matt and I are talking about, or have been talking about, are using technology, cell phone data, some other data we have access to really get a sort more of a true read on these fares and who's there, how many people are there, kind of independently of the fares, maybe, which would be eye-opening in a lot of ways, I think, because I've already run some numbers. And some of these fares that have these giant numbers, just not proving out to be anywhere near that number. And some are right on, some are very close. It could be an interesting thing. We're talking now about it, and maybe we'll roll it out next year. I'm not sure, but it would take the having to wait for reports or having to accept the numbers that are given to us anymore. And it's a pretty accurate way of doing things. We've been doing a little testing with certain fares, which share their true numbers, and it's pretty close. It's pretty darn close in a lot of ways. So that might be an interesting thing next year. It might get some people mad at us because their attendance is,
It sounds like a
60% of what it was or something along those lines. But I think getting true numbers is is our responsibility because there are, we're a big friend of the industry. We're definitely in the industry, and we love the industry, but we're also a trade publication. We need report information, right? So we have sometimes a conflicting responsibility to a certain extent because, the fair maybe doesn't want this to get out, or the carnival doesn't want this to get out. But, we sort of have a responsibility to report things, and if they're newsworthy, not nonsense, but newsworthy, to get it out there. And I know you've run into it with interviews you've done, the questions you've asked, and people have pushed back. And why is he asking this? Why is he asking that?
Not
But
too, actually, not too much. I mean, yes, that exists, but
well, you haven't heard it, but we have.
oh, shit. Uh-oh.
Nothing you did was egregious. There were questions you'd ask, but people are sometimes sensitive. Maybe the fair is under some pressure on certain things. Maybe the carnival is under pressure to bring in a new ride, and they didn't. And you ask them what rides are new this year, and then they get annoyed. It could be a lot of things, but nothing you asked wasn't legitimate. And
Interesting.
sometimes people are just a little sensitive to what you might ask. And I don't think we ask anything that's out of bounds in any way. Do you, Matt?
No, we're very sensitive to all that stuff. We always have been, we've always been a friend of the industry, like you said, and
Yeah.
you know.
Well, distance and objectivity seems to work from my perspective. So that's what I, you know, I try to use, you know, that's part of the game, so to speak. But it, one of the, like, some of the tricky questions, like revenue and revenue increases and per cap spending, which is, I really can't stand that metric, but I often ask it. But so when it gets to attendance is one thing, but trying to gauge the economic revenue of the fair and economic impact of the fair, that get, that's a little bit trickier to navigate. And there's probably some political, in the sense that, what, you know, the government agencies involved and that sort of thing. So I can understand their sensitivity. And sorry, I mean, I have to ask, and no comment is well, what I'll use, but I don't know.
If they want to answer and they want to, I mean, some people are very forthcoming. They say those things, and some people are a little more sensitive about it and they don't say it. So fine, whatever. You don't answer.
It's interesting how many ask the question
is a whole different ballgame, because I don't see anything wrong with asking the question.
Well, I never hesitate to ask anything anywhere, anytime. Just like, I don't know. I just like to ask questions.
Matter of fact, I'm glad you said that, because we have a special guest coming on right now. The owner of Wade Shows. I'm just kidding.
Seriously? No.
Poor Tim got nervous.
Yeah,
well, you know, it's funny. Somebody said to me, because you said you're distant, and you are. We never even seen you.
That's true.
But, you know, I had one person tell me one time that you were partial to their rival, because you were close to them or something like that. And I said, Tim is not close to, he doesn't know anybody. He knows no one. I said, you're crazy. There's no way that he's, you know, he's being biased in some way, or friendly with somebody and not friendly with somebody else.
Partial to another ride company, another carnival?
Yeah, something like that. It was a question you asked or something along those lines, but.
For a regular fair story? I mean, I like to know equally.
I don't know if it's a regular story or a question you ask. And it really doesn't matter. But the point is that that's the perception, you know, it's like, cause there's a lot in this industry, there's a lot of, you know, rumors, or they think things, and, you know, something like that. But
I
can, you know, confidently say for sure that you don't know anybody. You've never met anybody. It's an interesting, and I don't think any of our riders really have, with the exception of Mary, maybe, has, you know, met some people because she's a little more involved, but you know, our other writers have never met anybody in the industry. They've talked to them.
I just can't think of what purpose would I have of preferring one carnival company to another in terms of the story, because usually not in the same story. So, yeah.
Well, it's just craziness. So what did you see with the top 50 list? Did you draw any conclusions, or what did you see?
I think there's a few things, but I think this whole idea, and actually we've talked about this, Ron, a little bit recently, you know, everybody's talking about the graying of the industry, and also like the demographic for fairs is aging, and, you know, they do a lot of senior citizen stuff and all that, but I think that's turned around. I think
100% it's turned around. I just went to the convention. It wasn't graying at all. It was young. It was really
and young. But I think that's also happening with the fair programming. And I think that what we're seeing, is, especially post-lockdown, is a lot of fairs are attracting millennials. And a lot of millennials are starting to have families. And also, I think a lot of millennials are just moving into different areas than like different parts of the country. There's an influx of new and more diverse demographics, populations within the regions. And I think that is having, obviously it didn't happen overnight, but I think you're starting to see steady progress in that area. That this year it seems a lot more visible. I think part of it is that the social media and stuff that fairs are doing has evolved and become more effective, but also is usually done by younger staff members, and they're hiring staff to do it, as opposed to before the pandemic, it seemed it was more of an afterthought of the marketing department. And now there's a bunch of young folk, millennials, who are, quite adept and skilled at social media marketing. And I think you're starting to see that repercussion of that payoff.
I think one of the other big draws too, you mentioned entertainment, for millennials and, a little younger entertainment and stuff like that. Food has been a huge trend, like all the foodies have kind of come out, and, it seems like all the concessionaires and fairs, take pride in trying to come up with the craziest new food items. And a lot of them publish that, like Minnesota publishes something every year, the top, 20 new food items, and, people go crazy over it. I mean, there's lines, to try some of these items. And I think that's been a huge draw for a lot of fairs and carnivals too, to be honest. I mean, even local carnivals, I see people who, just want to go down to, a festival just for a funnel cake, or something like that. So I think that's been a huge draw, probably the last, at least the last 5 years, it's really increased, I would say.
One thing I noticed related to that is that there seems to be a little more local coverage of the fairs, because when I do research on each fair before I come up with the same old questions, but food is always like a major part of all the coverage. And I mean, Food Channel, that Carnival Eats and all that, people just love the fair food and comfort food. And so I think that's coupled with that. It sort of fuels a lot of the local coverage because food is such a, everybody's into food these days. So I think that is sort of leading the coverage. But aside from the food coverage, there is a little bit more coverage of fairs, especially the pre-openings and all that, that I was seeing a few years ago. And I think that's really good to see. And I think also a lot of these local news sources are really struggling to stay in business, and hyper-local coverage would include the state fair. And also I think they wouldn't be covering it if there wasn't a demand for it. And I think part of that demand for it is that like Americana, Cowboy Cool, all that kind of stuff is sort of out there in the ether, and you're seeing a different attitude among millennials towards that, and which is refreshing and good for the business.
You know, it's funny. Well, first of all, I want to say in your year-end article that you said Americana, and then you're talking about the Calgary thing in Canada. I was like, I changed it to Western because it really is a Western thing, not just American, the cowboy.
I thought I put Americana in quotes.
Yeah. I was like, you're going to be offended and call me up and yell me. But
they're one of the nice things.
One story I would like to investigate a little bit of, because I'm curious, is like these crazy foods that they, you see featured every year, pickled pizza or, deep fried cockroaches or something like that. Are those big sellers, or is it just the notoriety that they're getting, the publicity they're getting to draw people to the stands? I'd be curious, with some of these people like Chicken Charlie out in California and some of the people on East Coast, to interview them and see, is the new food, and I'm talking about crazy foods, not just a cool twist on something, but do the crazy foods really sell big, or are they just, incentive for people to get news and for people to come? Because that'd be interesting article about that, because I think it's probably, my guess would be, it's probably just the publicity arm that's getting more. We were talking about to one of the fair managers I was interviewing about big name acts, and he said, a lot of the fair, the buzz or whatever, is about who he books. And he said, did you go see him? And they're like, no, but I know the fair is good this year because you have X, or something like that. So, I'm curious, interview some of these people that do introduce these new crazy foods year after year. Are the foods that they introduce profitable and popular, or do they do it mostly because, it brings eyeballs to publicity to get to the fair?
That's sort of It's an interesting question. I imagine a lot of the new foods are from existing concessionaires who introduce something new. So, and to keep the mix.
Almost all are.
Yeah. And I also, I wonder how many of the new foods sell for the repeat visitor. I mean, I could see somebody, I got to have my annual funnel cake, but if I go another day to the fair, well, I'll try the new pickle pizza, which quite frankly, I don't understand. Pickles are big.
It's the slice. They put the sliced ones on there, Tim.
I know.
Yeah, like that.
I mean, but for some reason, what is with, I mean, in the fairs, yes, but also pickles seem to be the you know, a food of the year or something. People just seem to like pickles.
I tried Ricky Uckmars one time. It was actually not as bad as I thought it was going to be. It was pretty okay. And I'm a, you know, like you, I'm a North Jersey Italian. So I'm very particular about pizza. I don't eat it that much, but when I do, I want to make sure it's good. But it wasn't really that horrible, honestly. It was like kind of weird.
Yeah, and he's one of those who benefited from that. I mean, he was, you know, he was given an okay location in Minnesota with his food trailer, but they publicized the pickle pizza so well that, I mean, he had lines every day. You know, he said we would open the doors and people would be lining up, you know, ready to buy that pizza. And even in the second year, it was still popular. And like I said, his location wasn't, wasn't like he was right in the middle of everything. You know, he was kind of off to the side and kind of tucked in. And, you know, they found his trailer and they it was well received, very well received there, you know. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah. It's definitely trending.
But I think that's a story, Tim. I think that especially this time of year would be a good thing to do is see how financially popular it is. Directly financially, I mean, as far as sales of that item. Well, but then in the global sense, if you attract people to your stand like Ricky did in Minnesota, that's an interesting thing too. So,
well, yeah, and some people use it as an edge too to get into the fair, you know?
Right.
And I don't know if that was Rick's case. I can't remember for Minnesota, but
I don't think so.
Know, I don't remember on his, but you know, some guys might say, "Hey, I got this new hot item," and you know, that could be their way in, you know? So that's something to look at too.
Yes. Well, I usually do a food trend story in conjunction with the Gibtown stuff, Florida Week and whatever. And
stop saying Florida Week.
Oh yeah, I forgot you got a thing about that.
That's banned from Carnival Warehouse.
Okay. Good to know. Hey, you know, one trend, because I'm switching the subject, but one trend for this year that I think that the fair industry could take some pride about was that this whole disruptive teen thing in our that was a very major story the last year and this year. It seemed that it kind of got quelled by the end of the year. You didn't see this disruptive teen stuff happening this year towards the end of like the you know, from July onward, which is sort of like the bulk of the season. You didn't see that happening. And also every fair implemented some new security measures and had more police presence, drones, and that sort of thing. And I think that the security and safety aspect of fairs really really met the challenge this year. And I think that is cool. You know, I think that should be something that should be noted. And I'm sure the IAFE has somewhat to do with it. And it seemed to be a very concerted effort that was successful.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I've heard a couple in the end of the year, but not like the big news it was. Did they send all those drones up to New Jersey, by the way, that they used?
They're
looking for you, Tim. They heard you live up there now.
Like three Tuesday night around 10:30, I heard what had to be a drone. It sounded like a lawnmower, but was like above my apartment building. And there was just, I just saw it. There were, and then like, I heard it for like 10 minutes. I'm like, what the heck is that? And I said, that's got to be a drone because it's all over the news up here. Then I heard a bunch of police sirens. And then what do you know? I've been reading reports that people are saying that there's drones in Jersey City where I live. So we have, I haven't seen one personally, but it's been kind of a major story. It's kind of strange. But maybe it's, yeah, but well, whatever, you know, I wonder if it's like the drone races that a lot of fairs are doing, which I don't, they didn't seem to mention drone races this year as much as they did recently. So
yeah, the drone thing and even the displays didn't take off as big as I thought. I mean, I think they look kind of cool, but, and they're getting better at it, but initially they weren't that all that impressive. They were kind of impressive, but it took a lot of drones to make anything look decent. Think.
Yeah, but I think that drones being used for security and safety have probably made a very big impact. Yeah, mm-hmm. I'm sure for monitoring crowds and all that.
Yeah, especially when they carry those little darts and missiles, they just hit the kids or whoever's acting up, tranquilize them.
They have that. Good. I thought it was just lasers, but darts are good.
So on the carnival side, sort of the big. People are doing well and they're buying stuff, but these lead times on getting rides is such a big story right now, right, Matt? I mean, we saw it in Iapa and saw it other times. I mean, you've got to wait. I was just talking to Guy Levitt from Ray Kamik Shows, and you know, lead times are 2, 3, 4 years to get equipment, which they're not used to planning that far out. A lot of guys, so it's also given a boost to people that can deliver more quickly too. So that's another side of it. Is the people that do have the capacity to make it, it's been good. But a lot of people are waiting, you know, KMG or some of the bigger, more popular ride manufacturers are years out. It's, you know, 2, 3, 4 years.
Yeah, I was interviewing a carnival company yesterday, just finishing up the story that I'm sending in. Is it? I'm on deadline. You'll get it soon. But you'll get it this week, I swear. But the person, she said to me, that it was, it's really more company by company. That some companies are the lead times are very extended, but other companies have come back to what it was like pre-pandemic. So I don't know how widespread that might be.
It sounds like most of them are, you know, if you get a guy that's, you know, 2 years out, that's probably about the lower end now.
Yeah.
You know, some of them, you know, we heard at IAPA was, you know, 2029, 2030. Right. Yeah. You know, most of the European guys who have maybe a little bit bigger inventory of rides they manufacture or something like that, or higher demand, you know, because they're the only ones to build a certain piece or something like that. But yeah, mm-hmm. I mean, even some around this area, you know, I've heard, you know, 2 years, you know,
yeah,
one year would be a super lucky scenario, which I haven't heard any 1 year deliveries. So
yeah, it's strange how the global shipping that was so disrupted from the pandemic has it's a kind of a two steps forward, one step back recovery cycle. Like it's still not where it was before the pandemic, and one has to wonder why. Although I guess some of the shipping prices have stabilized.
You know, it wasn't so much shipping. When I spoke to a couple guys at IAPA, ride manufacturers, mostly from Europe are the ones I talked to, but a lot of their issues were still with labor, you know, finding guys who would work. And some of them said, well, we could find people who will work, but they'll only work 20 hours a week or something like that. So they had to hire more people just to meet, you know, production demand and stuff like that. So I think labor is still a huge issue. You know, obviously we know labor is a huge issue with carnivals and operating rides, but also with, you know, the manufacturing side as well.
Yeah, I think a lot of them trimmed their workforce, you know, because of the pandemic, and then, you know, getting them back wasn't so easy, especially if the person had a, you know, a specialized job in some way or another, or something else that had to be trained. And I think some of it, you know, people are keeping their expenses down too, so they don't get bloated and get caught in a situation like they did in the pandemic when they had all these people and they didn't really need them or whatever. They're probably, profits are probably up, but, you know, they probably need to, they're probably doing it manageably, I guess, is a way to put it. You know, they're putting out however many rides they do. They know they're going to make it a profit, you know, putting out 3 rides a year or whatever it might be. And you know, it makes sense for them instead of being bloated and fighting to get the fourth or the fifth one out.
They've adjusted their production cycles because you don't want to, you know, go to over, you know, it's better to be under capacity than over capacity. So they might have affected the lead times as well.
But I think the interesting thing, and we'll be covering this, Tim, is a lot of shows have multiple rides coming in the next several years.
Yes. So
there should be plenty of stories about, you know, what's coming and what's, you know, coming the next couple of years and how things are going. And there's always going to be something new because people have to plan now. They can't just make a phone call and have a ride shipped to them tomorrow. And even the used ride market is, you know, pretty much non-existent. I mean, for quality stuff, I mean, there's junk out there, but there's not a whole lot of good rides. And when there are, they get snapped up pretty quickly.
Interesting. Yeah, I know that there's a lot of refurbishing and reconditioning going on.
Yes.
I'm wondering how much of that is a result of trying to fill the demand.
Well, it is. I mean, it, just like you're saying, it's can't buy a new ride. The used rides are not really there either. So, yeah, you refurbish because they have the capacity to do that. You know, a lot of shows anyway.
Yeah, it's very interesting about the rides because it's sort of like a overlooked or not fully recognized entertainment business, and you know, which has to do with popular culture and all that. So I'm interested in watching the trends on how midway companies are adjusting the ride selection for new demand and new audiences and all that. You know, spectacular rides, family rides, and all that, high capacity rides. It's a very interesting kind of pulse to look at or take.
Yeah, and now with the electronic ticketing, or you know, or if you're just paying attention to weighing tickets or whatever you're doing, you know, you have pretty good data on what's popular, what's doing well. I mean, obviously, a kiddie ride can't make as much as a big ride, but you can tell which ones are popular, which ones aren't, and adjust accordingly.
Yeah, you know, that's something to keep an eye on. I'm talking to myself now because, you know, like one of the, all these, you know, cashless systems, for lack of a better general term, they've sort of been around for a few years now. And that data, we can see the uses of that data and the ramifications of that. So that'll be interesting to see emerge this year or next year.
And, you know, the same's kind of true on the park side. We've seen a lot of investment, a lot of new building, a lot of new things going on. the park side, I know you don't cover that quite as much for us, but you got your fingers in it a little bit. But there's, you know, a lot of new rides going up, a lot of new, even new parks being built. Universal's putting up a new park in Orlando. People are putting up all kinds of things all over the place. Have you seen a lot of that, Matt?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even you know, Disney, and I hate to refer to them because they are the top, but
what else would you refer to?
Well, of course, but you know, even they're expanding and, you know, creating new lands and, you know, new attractions. And, you know, of course, you know, their attractions are extremely, you know, costly to produce, you know, not like just buying a flat ride or, you know, something like that and putting it in a park, you know? So yeah, you know, you see the demand all over, you know, and like you said, Universal, even some of the smaller parks, you know, they're, you know, buying new equipment and upgrading old stuff. And, you know, Six Flags Great America by me in Gurnee, Illinois, they're putting up a new coaster next year. And so yeah, there's an investment all over the place.
Yeah. It'd be interesting to watch.
And these are long-term investments, both on the carnival side, the fair side, and the amusement park side, which, you know, speaks to the optimism that people have for the long term, because you don't, you know, invest millions or tens of millions of dollars in something if you don't think things are somewhat rosy going forward. I see a big push with the seasons passes. That's, you know, the last, I don't know how many years, but the seasons passes and the incentives for seasons passes have kind of gone crazy. I know my couple of my kids were by Busch Gardens Williamsburg, but they had all these incentives. You could get, you know, free this or free that, or get points for something. And my daughter was driving up there for an hour just to pop in to get some kind of incentive or something like that in certain cases. But I think they're really working the season pass angle and the people that are close by, you know, especially for those parks aren't, that aren't purely destination parks.
Interesting. Yeah.
What do they do to incentivize you with Disney, Matt? You already go 90 times a year.
There's no incentive for the annual pass there. They just charge you more money and then we pay it because we're addicted. they said the price went up and then we say how much? Okay, here's the money. Just take it.
I thought Disney was putting out a few incentives though. I saw.
Yeah, there's probably, you know, I don't pay attention to a lot of their incentives, to be honest. You know, I'm speaking only from the annual pass side, but you know, probably Florida residents. I know the cruise line does a lot of Florida resident discounts and stuff like that. And, you know, maybe if you're buying a 3 or 4 day park hopper, there might be incentives. Or I know they brought back like the dining plan for resort guests and stuff like that. So there's incentives out there. I honestly haven't paid much attention to them. You know, we have an annual pass and we have an out of state annual pass, and there is no financial incentive that they give us. They just raise the price. So that's it.
Well, they have a map on the people who drank the Kool-Aid and they know where they are.
They do. I think so. They know we're hooked, so it's okay. They just keep charging us.
A lot of people drank that Kool-Aid. I do. Well, with fares, there does seem to be a push to make, to create more multiple visits during the run of the fair from individual fairgoers. That seems to be something that fairs are starting to incentivize.
I'm glad to see that, because I think that was a thing that they got away from for a little bit, with especially with pricing. I mean, I talk about it all the time, but fares were made to go multiple times. I mean, that's important. And by raising prices and making things you know, a one-time event like at a destination amusement park or something like that, I think that's a tough strategy for a fair, because I think people have to go multiple times. It needs to be your annual event. I was talking to the manager of the Iowa State Fair, and he used to be at Clay County, which is a huge county fair, but you know, a smaller fair. And, you know, basically it's a town cell. I mean, everybody from the town works there, lives there, does everything there. And that's where, you know, the sort of the heart and soul of the fair business are those county fairs. And you've got to have people come all the time. I know when I run an event, when I see somebody not at the fair, I'm like mad. I'm like, why aren't they there? You know, why? What am I doing wrong? Why aren't they at the, they should be there every day. You know, as a matter of fact, Tim, you know, I always say, it's funny because you brought this up, but when I was a kid, OLV used to have a carnival. Remember back in the day?
Yes. I do remember some carnivals at OLV.
Yeah, they had a little carnival, and I could ride my bike there. I was pretty close. And the first time I went, you know, I had money. I went on everything and did whatever I wanted to do. Second time, I had a little less money, but I still, you know, went and did some things. And then I would probably go a third time, but I'd be, you know, picking up the couch cushions to see if I could find some quarters or something like that to save enough to ride the, you know, whatever, the rollerplane or something like that, because whatever my favorite ride was. But you know, I think there are, you know, diminishing returns. But now with credit cards, it's not quite as pronounced. But, you know, you got to get people to go multiple times, because when you get them there, they're going to spend some money no matter what, you know, but the key is to get them there.
Well, I think, you know, another thing related to that I have been, that I definitely noticed this year, is kind of like a destination marketing aspect to fairs, where they're really doing a lot of collaboration with like the CVB of the state and that kind of thing. And so many of them, especially the big ones, happen during the summer. And I think that is sort of tied with incentivizing multiple visits. Go for the weekend instead of just a one-off day. And I think that you're starting to see that, those sort of two trends coinciding, or confluence might be the word.
Yeah, New York, I don't know if they did it this year, but in the past several years, they worked closely with their I Love New York campaign.
Yes.
Statewide, I think they gave them like $1 million to promote the state fair and get people to come up there and do things. So
yeah,
and state fair in Illinois, Matt, has had a resurgence in the last couple of years, growing attendance. You know, they had a big investment too in their fairs and their fair. State put money in.
Illinois is a really interesting fair, because it was a little bit, I don't want to use the term sketchy, but it was hard to get a story done to find somebody to interview before the pandemic. And I'm not using, I'm using the pandemic just like just for a few years ago, but recently, like they have really been on a growth trajectory. And I think a lot of it and is the support they're getting from the state government in terms of reinvesting in the fairgrounds and seeing the fairgrounds as a as an economic engine in the town. I mean, excuse me, in the state, of course. And also they it's not surprising that it's more of a destination. At the same time, they just like upgraded a bunch of buildings and added a new building. I forget the figure they put on it. And you really see that paying off. Man, the Illinois State Fair, that is one fair that whose attitude has done a 180 or 360, whatever the opposite is. but it's really good to see. I think they're like they're vying for their position in the Midwest Fair, you know, universe, which is so iconic.
You know, the Illinois State Fair is so interesting because, you know, you think Illinois, you know, you think, you know, the big city of Chicago and, you know, I live close to Chicago. I'm in the northwest suburbs of Chicago. Wow. I haven't been to the Illinois State Fair in years. And most people up here in our region, in the Chicago region, do not attend the Illinois State Fair. You know, it's a 3.5-4 hour drive for most people. And it's not a draw. It's not really even marketed in our region up here. If anything, people go to the Wisconsin State Fair in Milwaukee who live in Chicago because it's actually closer. For me to get to Milwaukee, it's an hour, hour and a half sometimes, depending on traffic. And Wisconsin State Fair actually does a lot of marketing in the Chicago area versus the Illinois State Fair does not because it is a little bit further away. You know, Springfield's, you know, a lot further down and you know, they attract more from that geographic area than they do the northern tier of the state.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure that's true, but I'm wondering if it's as true as it was. I think that might be, I think you might see that change a little bit.
You know, I think there are people that, that probably would attend the fair from the Chicago area. I don't think it's that many. And I think mostly it's just, it's because it's a long drive. It is, you know, it's a good distance away, you know, unless there was some unbelievable act or something like that, that drew them down there, or they're just fair crazy or something like that. And just really want to go to the fair. But I think the most of the people who live in the Chicago area do not attend the Illinois State Fair. You know, they attend, you know, there's a lot of local fairs, you know, local county fairs in our region, you know, that draw very well. And, you know, of course there's festivals in every suburb, every weekend, pretty much the whole summer season. So, you know, there's plenty of things to do, you know, so there's not a whole lot of draw for Chicago people to go to the Illinois State Fair. Now that's not to take away from what they did do. I mean, she's done a great job growing that fair, you know, over the last couple of years. And, I'm happy to see the attendance go up, but it is interesting, you know, for people outside the state and you think Illinois State Fair, pretty much all of Chicago does not attend it. You know, it's kind of interesting.
Huh.
It should be an interesting person to have on. I'll put her on my list. There's so many interesting people out there, but
yeah, just to talk about the.
I didn't hear you.
His technology's out.
Okay.
Can we hear you, Matt?
You froze up.
Yeah, no audio. Can't hear your volume.
Oh, there we go.
Okay, am I back?
Yes.
My phone rang and it did some crazy iPhone stuff. Anyway, yeah, I think that'd be really interesting, Ron, you know, to talk about how they grew the fair and, you know, that type of stuff. So that'd be a great guest to have on.
You know, the other thing I'm going to bring up is Tim's favorite subject. Do you know what your favorite subject is, Tim?
I don't know. Dostoevsky? What? I don't know.
Dostoevsky. Yes. Crime and Punishment I was going to talk about. The is musical acts.
Yeah, well, it's that time of year again when I have to come up with the question for the upcoming thing. The upcoming.
How was 2024? Did you see a change at all, or is it still a rough game?
You know, everybody says that it's still a seller's market, and costs are rising. But if fairs have not abandoned, if they haven't abandoned their headline acts now, it's still a major point of emphasis. And I think that I think that it's going to be a very interesting year. And so I think fairs are really recognized as a major stage, especially during the summer and especially in the Midwest. And I think that is there seems to be a bit of resurgence. Aside from the general trend story, the tribute act band, business is growing. And I think that is going to be, especially as the tribute acts replace the regular acts who are aging and passing away. I think that overall, in terms of the entertainment culture, but also specifically the fairs, I think that's going to become a very, that has a more dynamic aspect to it than one might see conclude from just looking at the surface of things. So I think like what's happening with the tribute band acts and as filler for like the headline acts, I think that's going to show a lot of activity now. I mean, I think you're seeing some of these tribute acts go from the free stage to the grandstand stage.
Yeah, we at my fair up in just north of you in Middletown, New York, that I run, I have all tribute acts pretty much. I mean, back in the day, we had Metallica and Van Halen and all people on the stage, but on the grandstand stage. But now we have a little like amphitheater. Put up the tribute acts, and they're relatively inexpensive, but they're great. They're fantastic, and they draw people. You know, they do really well. And you know, as you mentioned, you kind of glanced at it, but like Foreigner is a tribute act. There's nobody in Foreigner that was in Foreigner. Jones plays once in a while, but not really. You know, doesn't exist.
One of many. I mean,
yeah, there's quite a few. I think 38 specials that way. There might be one guy or something like that. It still plays, but it's those are, you know, there's a lot of them that are essentially tribute acts, you know.
Leonard Skinner is like that, and like the Four Tops or Temptations, a lot of those.
All those 50s bands they might wheel out one guy that was somewhere near the band at one point, but, you know, essentially they're all new, you know.
But I'm sure they put on great shows, and I'm sure it's not easy being a human jukebox like that. And I think that there'll be some more creative input into those tribute acts because they're really filling a lot of that space in the, you know, there's a bit of a vacuum when it comes to fairs because nobody's really sure what would be the best act, you know, the whole conversation about the up and coming acts are too expensive. You have to get them in time. Big acts are too big. They don't play. But I think that's, we're going to see a reconciliation of that. I think that, I think that the live concert aspect of fairs, especially the big ones, is going through an evolution that is really kind of interesting to observe.
You had in those other, the up and coming acts or whatever you want to call them, new acts, you know, back in the day, you could afford to take a chance because they were relatively inexpensive. So you say, okay, I'll spend whatever, $20,000 and I'll see if they hit, or $10,000. But now you're taking big bets on these guys that are unproven. So, which is why so many people move towards the sort of the guaranteed acts. But their prices got driven up, you know, but for a number of reasons, but that's one of them. And festivals have done it too. And all those things, it's a tough business to be in. It's no question, but you see a little bit of a leveling off because some of the tours are getting canceled and ticket sales aren't what they used to be. So maybe the fairs will play a big role coming up soon.
Everything is so fractured that it's hard to find an act that's so mainstream, like Taylor Swift, you know, that kind of thing. They're few and far between. So people are Taylor Swift, who got her start playing fairs, which is I remember when I was with my previous magazine, I was writing a little bit about fairs and all that. Taylor Swift was coming out, like doing a lot of fairs, like probably around about 10 years ago or a little, or like 2011, that kind of thing. So she would always, she'd always take pictures with the fair managers and all that.
Well, and people are moving to, you know, ethnic acts, Spanish acts, comedians, that, you know, yeah, trying to fill in the void with other things that are a little different niche.
EDM.
EDM.
And DJs. I'm not sure how those have taken off, though.
Yeah, I don't think they're quite as, they have the mainstream as the other places do. Oh, well, guys, believe it or not, we've been talking almost an hour here.
Okay.
Or good. Tim has.
Yes. Well, I have a lot to say. I am usually the one asking questions. So
it's very Matt, rare. You have anything to say the year?
Hello, Matt?
I think he's frozen again. I think he put up a cardboard cutout of his face.
Well, it's a pretty good one.
Well, we just Matt and I just want to thank everybody for listening and for reading and for doing all the things that you do during this past year. Our advertisers, our staff, even Tim, appreciate all the work he's done over the year, and we couldn't do it without you guys. And we hope everybody has a good and prosperous new year, and we'll see you around the next year. Thank you so much for listening and reading.
Sounds good, and it's been fun, an honor, and a privilege. Thanks, guys, and thank you, Fair Industry, because you are wonderful to interview. It's really been did some good work, I feel, and I'm glad about that. So thank you.
Tim can go back in his cave now.
I'm back. Go back to my undisclosed location.
Thanks a lot, Tim. Thanks, Matt. I love your frozen picture. It looks great. We'll talk to you soon.